This week, France moves one step closer to proposed internet filtering. Google in lawsuit over automatic sharing of private information with Buzz. Schools in the U.S. now using laptop webcams to spy on your kids at home. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 16 for Thursday, February 18th, 2010.
The UK government is proposing a similar scheme. Copyright holders will inform ISPs of illegal activity. It's then up to the ISP to take steps against the file sharer.
Well, the government have said that they want to punish the 7 million file sharers there are in Britain. And the problem with that is that the criminal justice system in Britain only dealt with 2.1 million cases last year, and it simply can't cope with having another 7 million put on top of it.
If you think about the prospect of taking legal action against 7 million people, it's not a very effective way of proceeding.
It's unfair, it's terribly biased, and it employs one industry to do the dirty work of another industry, and we think that's wrong.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture, knowledge, control the world. And that is losing its last control points. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to the news stories mentioned during the show. And the intro clip off the top of the show is from the Pirate Party UK leader speaking on the BBC Click about copyright crackdown in the UK. And you can find that video link in the Pirate Party Radio forum so you can watch the whole thing. We have some incoming messages. This one's from Joel. A while back ago, I posted a music video from a Sony video in private mode so only I can view it on my iTouch. The file was taken down within 72 hours. Why would they care on a simple DVD rip that is in private mode only so I could see it? Well, Joel, because they have very, very, very expensive lawyers and expensive ad campaigns to convince people that even copies of media you've purchased cannot be manipulated for your own personal use. Now, it doesn't say where you posted it, but I'm assuming it's posted on not your website, not to your domain name, not to a server that you control, to more of a public server, say like YouTube or somewhere else that is publicly accessible, but you've kind of walled it off and said nobody else can see this except for me. Well, it's not just you that can see it. It's the company that you've posted it to. It's the website that you're hosting it on. And I'm sure somewhere in their agreement here, it says that you're not allowed to post copyright infringement material. Now, the question comes down to copyright infringement, whether a video that you own, let's put that in quotation marks, that you have the license for to watch personally on your home, at your home, using the officially sanctioned pieces of equipment that they have licensed to be able to view it. Now, there's so many things that are surrounding what is a way that you could watch your video. And this is one of the ways that they don't want you to watch your video. They don't want to manipulate it into a form that they have not sanctioned. And this is one of the ways that they have not sanctioned it. So in the future, what I would suggest to get around this is to not upload it to a public server, upload it to maybe your own server, because this would definitely fall under something like fair use, that I would think. And I'm guessing that you have put this file on the internet so that you could go somewhere and without crossing a border, maybe that they would search your equipment, because that's coming in more and more commonplace. As you cross borders between countries, they're going to search your laptop, they're going to search all the electronic devices and be the jackboots for the corporations locking down the evils of having stuff that you own on an unapproved device. So what you would be doing is uploading it to a temporary location so that when you get across to the other country, you can, you know, legally view things in a fair use way for stuff that you have purchased. And you've already paid money to the company that made this movie or music that you wanted to listen to. In this case, a DVD rip of something that you own. And something that you want to watch again, maybe on a different device. Now, the corporations would want you to buy this yet again for your device or stream it from their servers. Now, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because you've already given them the money for that movie. Why should you pay them 5 or 10 times just to see the exact same bits, but on a different device? It doesn't make a lot of sense, and this is what I'm guessing that you're trying to get around and doing, and it totally makes sense, and it should be legal because you own it. Now, are we going to have to prove that we own everything that we walk around with? We're watching a movie on our phone. Are the copyright cops going to come and pull us over and we'll have to present our license to watch this on our phone because this isn't a sanctioned version of it, yet we have the DVD at home? Maybe it's going to come to that. Maybe they're just going to lock it down completely and you're not allowed to watch anything anywhere except in the privacy of your own home with no more than one person, unless, you know, your friends have brought along their license to watch the latest movie at your house, because, you know, that's a public performance, especially if it's on a TV that's, 55 inches or wider, as news stories a little while ago was coming down on large televisions, indicating that's a public performance when the televisions are way too big. Your television is too expensive. You must be using it for public performances, especially when it's facing the window. Please face your television away from the window. I'll come off that rant and go to the next message. It's from Morps. In the latest Pirate Party Radio, you mentioned that ISPs respond to the complaints about file sharing to reduce bandwidth overhead. Well, I don't doubt that it's a contributing factor as someone who regularly receives and responds to these complaints. I work for a university and we're treated as an ISP in this regard. The primary reason we take them seriously is because under the DMCA, if we are notified of unlawful, in quotations, actions on our network and take no actions to stop it, we can be held liable for them. The letters that we get are called DMCA takedown requests and are the exact same style of letters sent to YouTube and other sites to get them to take things down. Obviously, I can't speak for all ISPs, but I can tell you that the threat of getting sued for some crappy Coldplay song a student happens to have on their laptop is much more of a motivating factor than the bandwidth usage. And different places will have different reasons for taking down these kinds of things and kicking people off their network. And as you can see there, universities have a different, I'm sure they all fear the DMCA, the heavy hand of the DMCA, which was a crafty piece of legislation put in a number of years ago by the corporations to, you know, control the media, really. Control what you see, where you see it, how you see it, and who you see it with. So if you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form, and it'll go directly to me. In pirate news, copyright news from the U.S. sent in by Weird Wolf. The U.S. announces intellectual property watchdog. The U.S. Justice Department is forming an intellectual property task force because of what some estimate to be billions of dollars of losses from copyright piracy. The movie and software industries have been hit hard by piracy, often international. The book industry is starting to be affected because of electronic books. The recording industry says that the vast majority of music consumed in China, once a center of illegal CD copying, is now downloaded illegally. The Justice Department said on Friday that the creation of the task force followed a meeting called in December by Vice President Joe Biden, which Attorney General Eric Holder and the other cabinet officials attended along with a who's who's from the movie, music, and book industries. The task force will allow us to identify and implement a multifaceted strategy with our federal, state, and international partners to effectively combat this type of crime, said Holder. Copyright thefts cost companies more than $25 billion each year, according to Howard Gantman, a spokesman for the MPAA. Public Knowledge's Art Brodsky said that he hoped the task force's emphasis would be on shutting down Chinese DVD and CD factories, rather than going after individuals. There is a balance in copyright law, said Brodsky, who sought to defend the person who maybe posts a song, somebody who has no intention of making money off of it. The idea that you could be fined several thousands of dollars for a 99-cent song is out of touch with reality. The task force will be chaired by the Deputy Attorney General, and other members will include officials from various divisions within the Justice Department. Gary Grindler is the currently acting Deputy Attorney General. The task force is to coordinate with state and local law enforcement with an increased focus on links between piracy and international organized crime. It will also coordinate with the Office of Victoria Espinel, the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator. The Justice Department's new task force will play a critical role in supporting administration's ongoing effort to protect American intellectual property and the millions of jobs that depend on it, said Espinel. The International Federation of the Phonographic Industry has estimated that for every song purchased, 20 are downloaded legally, losses that could reach billions of dollars. And from another story along the exact same lines, but with different quotes, and this is a quote from Vice President Biden, "Theft of intellectual property does significant harm to our economy and endangers the health and safety of our citizens. This administration is committed to stronger and stricter enforcement of intellectual property rights, and this new task force is a step in the right direction." I'm a little bit baffled on how it endangers the health and safety of citizens, of people downloading movies and music. Who is being physically harmed in this arrangement? It didn't exactly spell it out, but it's always nice to throw in those fear factors when talking about the corporations losing billions and billions of dollars. Now, do the corporations really think that there's all the American citizens out there and around the world are sitting with loads of cash in their pockets, just unwilling to spend it on movies and music and other media? That they're just like, they'd rather just, you know, download the music and movies rather than spend all this, you know, extra cash that they have lying around. And I think this is maybe the way that the MPAA and RIA are trying to kickstart the economy again by loosening up the pockets of the people of America so they can, distribute the wealth that they've been holding in their pockets, you know, that they aren't spending on the movies and music, you know, spending on, you know, mortgages and food and stuff like that. So I think they're a little bit out of whack with how much money they're actually practically losing. I don't think that money actually exists. And as I've said before, people have a limited budget on how much they can spend on entertainment. Once that budget has been filled, they're not going to spend any more. But yet, if they still have an appetite, they're going to seek out entertainment in any means they can. Whether because they can't buy it anymore, they're going to seek it out to maybe share it from their friends, get some off the internet or something like that. So they're all fighting for the same piece of pie. It's not a huge, massive pie like they expect it to be with the billions and billions of dollars that once was there and now it's taken a downturn. And they think that people are just holding back on the money that they used to have and they're just not spending any anymore because, you know, they don't feel like spending it on, the entertainment industry. Yet people are spending more on movies in the theater than ever before, talking out both sides of their mouth. It's a little bit weird when you deal with the movie and music industry and how they communicate their ideas across and how they don't embrace the new paradigm of digital entertainment. Author 17 says it's mixing, not plagiarism, sent in by DC. This was all over the internet. It usually takes an author decades to win fawning reviews, march up the bestseller list, and become a finalist for a major book prize. Helene Hedgman, just 17, did it with her first book, all in the space of a few weeks, and despite a savaging from critics over plagiarism. The publication last month of her novel about a 16-year-old exploring Berlin's drug and club scene after the death of her mother, called Axalthal Roadkill, was heralded far and wide in German newspapers and magazines as a tremendous debut, particularly for such a young author. The book shot to number 5 this week on the magazine Spiegel hardcover bestseller list. For the obviously gifted Ms. Hedgman, who already had a play written and staged and a movie written, directed, and released in theaters to her credit, it was an early ascension to the ranks of artistic stardom. That is, until a blogger last week uncovered material in the novel taken from a lesser well-known novel, Strobo, by an author writing under the nom de plume Aaron. In one case, an entire page was lifted with few changes. As other unattributed sources came to light, outsized praise quickly turned into a torrent of outrage, reminiscent of the uproar in 2006 over Harvard sophomore Kavya Viswanathan, who was caught plagiarizing numerous passages in her much-praised debut novel. But Ms. Hedgman's story took a very different turn. On Thursday, Ms. Hedgman's book was announced as one of the finalists for the $20,000 prize of the Leipzig Book Fair in the fictional category, and a member of the jury said Thursday that the panel had been aware of the plagiarism charges before they made their final selection. Ms. Hedgman finds herself in the middle of a collision, if not roadkill exactly, between the staid literary establishment in a country that venerates writers from Goethe to Man to Grass, and at the Berlin youth culture of DJs and artists that sample freely and thereby breathe creativity into old forms. Or as one character, Edmund, puts in the book, "Berlin is here to mix everything with everything." A powerful statement, but the line originally was written by Aaron on his blog. The plot thickens, however, and shows that perhaps more than the simple cribbing is at work. When another character asks Edmund if he came up with that line himself, he replies, "I help myself everywhere I find inspiration." Obviously, it isn't completely clean, but for me, it doesn't change my appraisal of the text, says Volker Weiderman, the jury member and book critic for the Sunday edition of the newspaper Frankfurter Allgemeine, a strong supporter. I believe it's part of the concept of the book. Although Ms. Hedgman has apologized for not being more open about her sources, she's also defended herself as a representative of a different generation, one that freely mixes and matches from the whirring flood of information across new and old media to create something new. There's no such thing as originality anyway, just authenticity, said Ms. Hedgman in a statement released by her publisher after the scandal broke. Now, I think people are reacting this way because writing is one of the older styles of creativity, and they're not used to seeing sampling and remixing happening with this form of art. Now, we've seen it time and time again through the ages with especially rap, where people are sampling other people's music and making it into their own new piece of artwork and new piece of music. Now, people can say that they don't like rap, but they can't really say that this is not creativity. Creativity, mixing it together and making it something new, something of your own, taking little samples here, there, and making it into a new piece of music. I'm sure this happened with paintings as well when pop art paintings first emerged and incorporated other people's artwork into their own. And certainly nobody cries foul each time Disney copyrights another public domain fairy tale for 90 years, or even when Star Wars is spoofed for the 10,000th time. It's not new, it's copying somebody else, therefore it's not artistically merited. I don't think so. I think it does have artistic merit, whether you're taking a piece from here, a piece from there, and making it into something new. It just hasn't been accepted into literary circles yet. And as it happens, more and more, I'm sure, will come to accept it, like we have for every other artistic medium, whether it's music or art, or movies even, and now getting into the realm of writing. Next door, Virginia legislators outlaw involuntary implantation of microchips. This was sent in by Ryan. Virginia legislators claim victory today. against implantable microchips by passing a bill that prevents employers or insurance companies from forcing patients to accept the devices. Privacy topped the reasons for concern, but the bill's sponsor also saw the microchip as the mark of the beast, according to the Washington Post. Presumably, most of the 88 legislators who voted in favor of the bill did so because of privacy concerns. Just 9 voted nay, and there was 1 abstention. Virginia also does not stand alone in taking a dim view of forced microchip implants. Really? Are people actually for forced microchip implants in the U.S.? Several states such as Wisconsin and Georgia also approve similar bans. I'm surprised they even have to put a law on the books that you can't force somebody to take a microchip and put it in them by law by your company so you can be tracked around. This is a bizarre story, but I continue. But the bill also took on religious overtones due to a belief shared by some fundamental Christians that microchips may represent the marks described in the Book of Revelation. It's a view supported by Mark Cole, the Virginia delegate who sponsored the bill. That has also allowed some critics to complain that the bill represented a sideshow that detracts from the more pressing concerns, such as Virginia's $4 billion budget gap. Microchips have also found growing use in medical applications, such as helping to reverse blindness. But the implantable microchip that seemed to worry people that most involved those would somehow track or monitor people. For instance, a UK school experimented with having students wear RFID chips on their bodies to track their movements. Microchips have also become popular in certain regions of the world where kidnapping poses a major threat. Regardless of religious belief, most people can probably agree that no one wants a corporation or government to forcibly implant microchips. But that doesn't mean plenty of patients couldn't benefit from a chip on their shoulder reminding of them when to take their pills. Of course, there's a huge difference between forced implantation of microchips or RFID tags or whatever have you for tracking you when you arrive at work and when you leave work and when you go to the bathroom, when you come out of the bathroom, lunch, and coming back from lunch, and between solving a health concern and opting to actually have this implanted by will. So this story is almost a non-starter. It's unbelievable that they have to pass a law that you can't be forced to be microchipped. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad they have a law that you can't be forced to be microchipped. But that's a bizarre story that I ran across. I couldn't believe it. Thank you, Ryan. Censorship news from Australia. Australians deserve an open internet. This sent in by Bethany. Electronic Frontiers Australia today launched a new campaign against the Rudd government's mandatory internet filtering plan. The Open Internet campaign emphasizes that Australians want an open internet that is free from an impractical and costly policy of government-imposed mandatory internet filtering. This policy has caused considerable anxiety amongst Australian internet users, said EFA Vice Chair Colin Jacobs. The idea that the government will be inserting itself in every internet connection in the country is a tough one to swallow, especially without workable policy goal behind it. Australians support an open internet that empowers individuals to decide what they view online, said Peter Blacks, EFA's campaign manager. Australians support an open internet that trusts parents to monitor what their children view online. The campaign is centered around a new website, openinternet.com.au blog, and a Facebook fan page that together will act as a campaign hub for all the different individuals and organizations that are campaigning against the government's mandatory internet filtering policy. The policy, which will see all Australian internet connections subjected to a government-controlled blacklist of banned sites, will apply to all Australian internet connections within 12 months of the legislation being passed. Although originally touted as cyber safety policy, the resulting filter will not filter out all material unsuitable for children, instead targeting a list of refused classification material, which would include content dealing with crime, drugs, and certain types of adult material. Concerns with the list include its broad scope, its secret nature, and its inability of Australian businesses to know if and when they have been placed on the list. One of our main concerns is how this list might expand in the future, said Jacobs. It's hard to imagine both this government and every government forever resisting the temptation from special interest groups as well as electoral and media pressure. The Open Internet campaign marks the escalation of opposition to the plan, which will continue throughout the year. Our goal is to ensure that the Australian public know what they're in for, said Black. It's important that such a major and expensive policy gets the public scrutiny it deserves. And we believe that Open Internet portrays a positive and understandable message that will resonate with Australians who are yet to form a strong opinion of the government's policy. Now, I sailed over to the Open Internet website, and the main points of the website are quickly laid out on the front page. One, the Australian federal government's pushing forward a plan to force internet service providers to censor internet for all Australians. The plan is to filter the internet, which will not protect children from inappropriate material. Two, the filter will not prevent criminals from accessing and distributing child sexual abuse material. This type of material is not distributed in the open, and we need to fund police to continue to infiltrate and prosecute the groups of people responsible for creating and distributing such material. And three, the filter will block access to material that is currently legal and possess and view. Just not to sell and publicly display. The list of material to be banned is much more than child sexual abuse material. The banned category of material is anything that has been refused classification, which in the past has included websites about euthanasia, controversial movies such as Ken Park and Baise-moi, and many games that are designed for people over 16 years of age. So go take a look at that website, openinternet.com.au, especially if you live in Australia, so you can see what your government is proposing to lock down the internet with for sites that are pushed through under the guise of protecting children, but really it's to protect everyone, and it's to protect you from things that you don't even know you needed to be protected against because the list will be secret. You could be placed on this list just for mentioning a word on your website, and all of a sudden you find that nobody in Australia can get to your website because you've been placed on the secret list. It's over for you. Is there even an appeal process to get yourself off the list? How do you even know that you're on the list to go to get yourself off the list? It's a very mysterious thing and should not be tolerated in a first world democratic country. Not good to follow in the footsteps of countries that are locked down, such as China or Iran or other countries like that, where the government oppresses its people through the censorship of information. We are in the digital age, and that is what is power. If the governments are trying to take away the power from the common person, and they do this by censorship under the guise of protecting the children. It is the secret key that unlocks, or locks in this case, up the internet. It's the magic words that everybody bows down to. Because you don't want to oppose something that's for child porn. Are you for child porn then? Well, you better vote on this bill to lock down the internet. That's how they push through all of these bills. So don't just gloss over these things when the government puts it in front of you and says it's for the children. Really, who is it for? Is it for the children, or is it for their own interests? Copyright and censorship news from the U.S. sent in by Crunch. Music journalism in the new piracy. Music journalism is the new piracy. Imagine you're a music journalist who maintains a blog. You've just found a great new, virtually unknown artist that you want to tell the world about. How can you do so in a way that is simple and convenient for your readers, but do not place you or your blog's hopes at risk of being sued? Increasingly aggressive copyright enforcement tactics of the music industry, this has been startlingly complicated question with no good answer. In the latest signal of this conundrum, at least six music blogs were deleted last week by Blogger due to copyright complaints. It's uncertain who made the accusations that led to the deletions, but the most likely culprit is the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, IFPI, a copyright enforcement organization that has previously filed copyright takedown takedown notices against some of the targeted blogs. Although the takedowns were made in the name of stopping piracy, the deleted blogs do not appear to have the hotbeds of illegal file sharing. Indeed, some of them have operated for years and acquired a serious and substantial readership. Like many of the music blogs and magazines, they mostly printed reviews of artists, albums, and concerts. In at least one case, IFPI's accusation of copyright infringement were almost certainly incorrect. Bill Lippold, author of the deleted I Rock Cleveland, has outlined in painstakingly detail the ways in which he received explicit permission to promote to post every file on his blog, including ones which were later accused of infringement and forcibly removed. In one case, the band's publicist wrote of the takedown, "Just so you know, this is none of our doing. Apparently, DMCA operate on their own set of odd rules. They even request that the band's official blog remove the song. What a headache." In cases like this, attacks on music blogs seem to be the latest example of the widening disconnect between the goals of the music industry's promotional wing and its enforcement wing. Smart musicians and promoters understand that the net is a powerful promotion tool and know that sharing the artist's music is the best way to earn new fans. The IFPI, on the other hand, writes clearly in its takedown notices that our top priority is to prevent the continued availability of the IFPI represented company's content on the internet. We've already seen this divergence of interest play out in the recent fiascos surrounding bands like OK Go and Death Cab for Cutie. The television industry has seen similar problems on its attacks on YouTube. In other cases, it appears that the bloggers may have posted or linked to copyrighted material without permission. But as targeted blogger Patrick Duffy explains, it's often next to impossible to know exactly which content is being accused of infringement. In their DMCA takedown letters, they never inform you what the infringing MP3s are, forcing the writer to take down all MP3s in the offending post, whether they have the permission to post them or not. If they have just included what the offending MP3s were, they could have avoided all of these headaches and bad press, and we could have kept going like any other day. Living Ears, another targeted blog, echoes those sentiments. One problem with these notices is that they do not mention infringing files by name. When I post the playlist from Seen Not Heard and link to a couple tracks, if I receive a DMCA notice, how can you tell which file is to be deleted? Targeted bloggers need to know these details, not only so they can remove the file if it's indeed infringing, but so that they can file a DMCA counter notice in the event that the file is not infringing. Ordinarily, the party issuing the takedown notice would be required by U.S. copyright law to specify which content is being accused. But as an international organization headquartered in London, the IFPI is arguing that that doesn't need to play by the USA's rules. "We neither admit nor accept," they write, "that Google is entitled to be served a notice in compliance with the DMCA. Translation, the IFPI is essentially threatening to sue Google under some unspecified foreign law, presumably one which lacks even the modest safe harbor provisions available in the USA. It's no wonder Google felt the need to take drastic action to avoid liability, even at the expense of the resulting headaches and bad press. By now, the affected blogs have mostly migrated elsewhere, and in most cases to software like WordPress, deployed on smaller and less well-known hosting services. While this will buy them some time, these smaller hosting services are just as vulnerable as Google as to attacks by the IFPI and their ilk. In fact, most smaller hosts are likely to even be less helpful to bloggers than Google has been, since they tend to lack Google's legal resources and PR imperatives." Wow, this is getting insane. So large companies outside of the US are now threatening US websites with international law, saying take down your website because something on it's infringing. We're not going to tell you which one. You better take it all down, or we're going to take you to court. And who's going to be able to have the money to stand up to these large corporations in court? Nobody. Not even Google is standing up to these people. And Google has some deep pockets. What about the individual? The individual has no hope. This is truly frightening in terms of censorship and copyright as well. They can take down something just because they don't like what you said. And they don't even have to say that. They just say, you're violating copyright. Take down your whole blog now. How did these companies get so much power in so little time that they can now act as censors of anything that they don't like without even having to justify themselves? It's because money rules. If they have the money, they can make the rules, and it's so obvious now. How are we going to stop this? How is it possible to even stop this unless the courts, unless they, where somebody is going to be able to stand up that has deep enough pockets to take them to court, to take them and take them to task on what they are proposing. And what they're proposing is just blanket takedowns of anything they don't like. And this is the only way that this is going to come to light, is if a high-profile case is taken to court. Now, I can't do this, and a lot of other people can't do this, and Google apparently is not even willing to step up to the plate. So who is going to take them if Google can't? It's going to take some deep pockets, so we're going to have to keep watching. I don't know how this is going to play out. No, everybody's going to be scared of posting anything online, or even talking about it, or even linking to it, because they're talking even about linking to something that's been posted by from an official source. So you can't even link to the official source. So they want to control exactly everything. You can't even talk about their... You have to go... The internet... They want to scale down the internet to their outlets. They want it to turn into television, where there's channel, where there's a Disney channel, and a CNN, and a Fox, and that's the outlets. Those are the choices you get. This fenced-in kind of internet, going back to the AOL days, where you have like 12 boxes on your screen, and those represent the 12 major parent companies. You can drill down into those parent companies and look at their subsidiaries and, you know, listen to corporate music all day long. That's not the future I want, and maybe it just needs to go underground. Maybe we just need to ignore this corporate music. Maybe we just need to go and listen and watch the independent music and the independent movies. And forget about these guys. Just ignore the whole industry and let the dinosaurs die and go with the new media. The free media, the distributed on the internet media. And forget the horse and buggy and whip manufacturers and go with what's new and forget the old. Copyright news from Poland. Three arrested as police swoop on a rapid share link forum sent in by Ryan. An internet forum which provided links to movies and TV shows hosted on sites such as RapidShare has been raided by the police. Following an anti-piracy group investigation, three alleged operators of the 30,000-member site were arrested, two of which were teenagers. Searches were carried out on members in three other locations. With 30,000 members, Filmowiski was a prominent file-sharing forum. Their site didn't host any illicit material, but many of its type linked to movies, TV shows, and other wares stored on hosting sites as RapidShare. Forum administrators are not responsible for content written by users. The files placed here by users are for promotional purposes. After 24 hours, you must delete all files downloaded from this forum, said the disclaimer on the front page of the site before it disappeared. Polish police and the Foundation for the Protection of Audiovisual Creativity, FOTA, anti-piracy group clearly didn't think the disclaimer counted for much, and on February 12 conducted raids against the site's operators. During the raid last Friday, police say they arrested three individuals on suspicion of running the site, a 21-year-old computer science student and two teenagers aged 16 and 17 also conducted searches on site members in three other locations. Equipment was seized, including six computers and 150 DVDs and CDs, which allegedly contained copyright-infringing content. After lengthy questioning, 21 and 17-year-olds were released and now face copyright infringement charges, which carry a maximum of 5-year prison sentence in Poland. The 16-year-old, which was reported yesterday as still being detained, will be dealt with by the family courts. The police were still officially confirmed the name of the site, saying that streaming movies were also available via the forum and that those arrested benefited financially from operating site as collected revenues from advertising. They add that the collected evidence is being examined by experts in order to assess the level of damages suffered by the creators of film and music whose work was linked to the site. Anti-piracy group FOTA, which awards the police with golden plate accolades for carrying out piracy crackdowns on their behalf, will undoubtedly be pleased with the result. Now, this is very interesting because if you just substitute the word Google for the name of the site that has been taken down and maybe the CEOs of Google in place of the names of the people that were arrested, this doesn't seem any different because Google does the exact same things. Maybe not in a forum, but their search engine does. These people did not host anything. They didn't host any copywriting infringing material. All they did was point to things. They pointed to where it was located, just like Google does. Google can link to torrents. Have you ever done a search on Google for torrents? It's all over the place. Very easy to find. Why don't they go after Google? Because it's not economically feasible. Because Google could fight back, and then where would they be? They need to set a precedence with the little guy first. The people, the 16 and 17-year-olds who don't have any money, who can't fight back, nobody's willing to fight back for them. Free speech news from Iceland. WikiLeaks and Iceland MPs proposed journalism haven. Iceland could become a journalism haven if proposal put forward by some Iceland MPs, aided by the whistleblowing websites WikiLeaks, succeeds. The Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, IMMI, calls on the country's government to adopt laws protecting journalists and their sources. It will be filed with the Althingi, Iceland's parliament, on 16th of February. If the proposal succeeds, it will require the Icelandic government to consider introducing legislation. Julian Assange, WikiLeaks editor, told BBC News that the idea was to try and reform Iceland's media law to be a very attractive jurisdiction for investigative journalists. He has been in Iceland for a number of weeks and is advising MPs on the IMMI. Alistair Moulis, professor of law at University of East Anglia, voices concerns at possible law changes. The hope is that journalistic-friendly laws will encourage media businesses to move to Iceland. If it then has these additional media and publishing law protections, then is likely to encourage the international press and internet startups to locate their services here, Mr. Assange said. He believes the political mood in Iceland is receptive to the need for change. The Icelandic press has itself suffered from libel tourism, so there does seem to be the political will to push this through. WikiLeaks is a non-profit website that has established a reputation for publishing leaked material. In October 2009, it posted a list of names and addresses of people said belonging to the British National Party. Other high-profile documents hosted on the site include a copy of the standard operating procedures for Camp Delta, a document that detailed restrictions placed on prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. It recently had suspended its operations because of a lack of funding. The IMMI aims to pull together good practice from around the world and incorporate it into a single body of law. We found good laws in different countries, but no country has all of these laws put together, said Mr. Assange. The proposal has been informed by WikiLeaks' experience in fighting the legal threats to publication. In my role as WikiLeaks editor, I've been involved in fighting off many legal attacks, as said Mr. Assange said in an email. To do that and keep our sources safe, we have had to spread assets, encrypt everything, and move telecommunications and people around the world to activate protective laws in different national jurisdictions. We've become good at it and never lost a case or a source, but we can't expect everyone to go through the extraordinary efforts that we do. Measures in the IMMI include legal protection for sources and whistleblowers and the protection of communications between sources and journalism. The proposals also include steps to end so-called libel tourism, the practice of pursuing libel actions in the most favorable legal jurisdiction, irrespective of where the parties are based. But legal threats are faced not by just by journalists, but by publishers, internet hosts, and other intermediaries, WikiLeaks says. As a result, the proposals include plan to clarify the protection for mere conduits. Once the proposals of supporters, Brigida Johnsdottir of the movement, a political party with three MPs in the Icelandic parliament, told the BBC that she was confident the measure would become law. From what I've experienced from discussions with the MPs from all the different parties, there is incredible goodwill. But the troubles of the financial sector may lead some Icelanders to be skeptical of efforts to transform their country, and Ms. Johnsdottir is aware of the need not to make exaggerated claims. We don't want to be the Vikings of transparency in the way the bankers presented themselves, she said. But Ms. Johnsdottir believed that making a strong statement in favor of freedom of expression could be a way for Iceland to create a positive new identity. There is still very many Icelanders who feel ashamed. I think this is part of the self-recovery we have to go through, she said. So this is very positive news for the freedom of speech, especially in publishing news that is somewhat controversial or kept down in the country that it is happening in. Now, WikiLeaks have done this for a number of years and has been very successful, as the article says. So I'm very looking forward to having WikiLeaks operate in Iceland and many other places like WikiLeaks, being able to move to almost a data haven of protection for free speech. Very exciting news on the Icelandic front. In worldwide privacy news, the dark side of geo, please rob me.com. Now, I know this is a bit exaggerated, a bit over the top, but it's an example of data mining gone awry. Now, everybody's made a big to-do. Oh, this is not really a big thing, but it's very interesting. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. More than a social statement, than an actual utility for aspiring Colton Harris Moore copycats, a new site called Please Rob Me has popped up to expose potential pitfalls of geolocation craze. If you're pushing a check-in from Gowalla Brightkite or Foursquare to a local restaurant out to your Twitter public stream, you're broadcasting that you aren't at home, which could be taken to mean that your home is ripe for burglary. Please Rob Me consists exclusively of an aggregation of public Twitter messages that have been pushed through the fast-growing location-based network site Foursquare, one of a handful of services that encourages people to share their whereabouts with their friends. You can filter by geographic location, too. On one end, we're leaving the lights on when we're going on holiday, and on the other, we're telling everybody on the internet we're not home, said the Please Rob Me site to explain its rationale. The goal of this website is to raise some awareness on this issue and have people think about how they use services like Foursquare, Brightkite, and Google Buzz, etc. Many people who use location-based services like Foursquare, Gowalla, and Looped kept their updates semi-private, opting to share them with a group of friends that's often much more exclusive than, say, Facebook friends list. But many others have become more comfortable with sharing all or some of these updates publicly, which seems innocuous if you're checking into a big party with dozens of other people. Granted, many of the same people who don't share any information about where they actually live or where they live alone in the first place, but it's still telling. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg likes to talk about how Facebook's gradual transition from exclusive password protection social network for college students to the ubiquitous database of often public information has rolled out in sync with people's information sharing comfort levels. A few years ago, mainstream internet users often didn't want to even use their real names online. Now, many are publicly sharing their locations in real time. There have been a lot of talk these days, particularly with regard to Google Buzz launch and Facebook's revamped privacy settings, about how much is too much. Now, with this ties into the next story about Google Buzz. Worldwide privacy news. Google sued for Buzz privacy issues. Now, Buzz just launched this past week, and a whole to-do about what's going on with Buzz. So, and also I have a link on the forums about how to protect yourself from Google Buzz, but let's get on with the story. The hype associated with Google's new social networking tool, Buzz, has turned a little sour on the tech giant. After responding to privacy criticisms of the service with an apology and an upgrade, Google is still being sued in America for failing to implement the privacy standards in the first place. The Federal Court of California received a class action lawsuit seeking to include all 31.2 million Gmail users as potential plaintiffs. Buzz was made accessible to Gmail account holders last week and was automatically activated for a number of users. This created publicly accessible lists of followers from people's Gmail accounts and past GTalk conversations. The lawsuit is concerned that a sensitive information related to some contacts may have been exposed in this rollout. Google has built in privacy controls into Buzz, although it wasn't clear how users could make their lists of followers private. We have heard from people that check boxes for choosing not to display this information was too hard to find. And based on this feedback, we've changed the notice to make it very clear, the tech giant said in a blog post. Google also said it has provided an opt-out setting in the Buzz setup for anyone who didn't want to publicly share their lists of followers or who they are following. We're making this option more prominent in the setup process to ensure everyone who wanted to hide these lists can do so easily. As a result, the continued complaints, Buzz will no longer automatically connect users based on their email and chat usage. Instead, you will see a list of connections to accept or reject. For the tens of millions of you who have already started using Buzz, over the next couple of weeks, we'll be showing you a similar version of this new startup experience to give you a second chance to review and confirm the people you're following, said Todd Jackson, product manager for Gmail and Google Buzz. Mr. Jackson had further apologized for the initial privacy oversight. We're very sorry for the concern we've caused and have been working hard ever since to improve things based on your free feedback. We continue to do so. So more and more of these stories are getting in the public, and these public social networking sites are really exposing how far people are willing to go to connect with other people by leaving their privacy out blowing in the wind. Anybody and everyone can see what you're doing if you make the slightest mistake when setting up these services, or even while these services are going into transition of a new form, such as Facebook, where it exposed pictures and information about people that once had it private, that automatically just converted over and shared it with the world. So a lot of stuff got exposed, especially some high-profile things, like the Facebook founder, who said it was no big deal, and then went on to hide his pictures that were exposed during the transition. So it was kind of a big deal. You obviously didn't want those to be exposed in the first place. Now, I was talking about that a couple weeks back when it happened. So Google's getting in on the act now, and they made the same missteps as Facebook by exposing way too many things without people realizing it. Now, I think the bigger issue is that people aren't realizing how much they're actually exposing to the world, whether it's through saying where they are in the world, whether they're out to lunch or whether they're on vacation, or who their friends are. The potential implications are staggering. You may not realize them now, but this stuff is stored forever. It's archived. Pages are archived at like archive.org and other caching pages. Google caches pages. Now, nothing's going to be private anymore. So you've got to think about, even if you're a teenager, if you're 16 and you're having fun right now, you may not realize the importance of what's going to come down the line when you're applying for a job in the future. Of course, everything's going to be in the same foothold in the future. Everyone's going to have their past opened up to every employer. So do you want to be the ones who has no past, or are you going to want to be the ones who has a private past or a very exposed past, or when you're partying when you're a teenager? Very staggering implications. So you really have to think about that. And some people just don't have the foresight to think about that, and or the technical knowledge as well. For some people who are really not quite as adept with computers, using them and clicking on things here and there, and they're not even knowing that they're exposing it because they see what they've inputted. They don't know what the rest of the world can see on these social networking sites and how much they're being exposed, because they never see the other side of the coin unless they have a tech-savvy relative or friend to warn them off, or a show like this. In free culture news, constant net connection required to play Assassin's Creed 2 on the PC. When we heard of Ubisoft's plan to require an internet connection for all their future PC games, we'd hoped they'd abort it or scale back in the face of the outrage and astonishment it caused. They haven't. It's all here. We've just received Assassin's Creed 2 and Settlers 7 for review and verified with Ubisoft Ubisoft that DRM is the same as the boxed product. If you get disconnected from the internet while playing, you're booted out of the game. All your progress since the last checkpoint or save game is lost. Your only options are to quit Windows or wait till you're reconnected. The game first starts on the Ubisoft game launcher, which checks for updates. If you try to launch the game when you're not online, you get an error message right away. So I tried a different test. Start the game while online, play a little, then unplug my net cable. This is the same as what happens if your internet connection drops momentarily. Your router's rebooted, or the game loses its connection to Ubisoft's master servers. The game stops, and I was dumped back to the menu screen. All my progress since its last autosaved was lost. Ubisoft asked us not to post shots yet, so here's my artistic impression of the screen you're dumped to, and it shows a picture of the screen. Ubisoft asked that we not show screenshots of Assassin's Creed 2 on PC, so here's my best MS Paint, blah, blah, blah. Even if everyone in the world had a perfect internet connection that never dropped, this would mean that anytime Ubisoft's master servers go down for any reason, anyone playing a current Ubisoft game is kicked out of it and loses their progress. Even massive multiplayer games aren't so draconian about the internet. You can't play when the server's down, but at least you don't lose anything for getting disconnected. The only benefit we're being offered is the ability to store save games online. Personally, I'm in the rare position of getting to play PC games at work. Even for me, this is the fringe benefit. How many normal gamers have two separate gaming machines in which they play a single player games? And how many of these don't know about Dropbox, Live Mesh, or any of the dozens of free services that already can sync your save games perfectly well? We've all seen it again and again that you can't stop the piracy scene from cracking your game and distributing it free of DRM. But you can stop the people who love your games from downloading it, and that you do so by making the retail experience better, not worse. That's crazy. Now you can't even play games without checking in. Even offline single-player games. So this is bad, bad news for people with poor internet connections or people who want to play the game while their internet is down or while they're traveling. So, you know, your internet's down. You can't surf web pages. Oh, I'll play my game. Oh, wait, I can't play my single-player game where all the data is stored locally because it can't check into the servers. It's also bad for people who don't feel like maintaining when they don't feel like maintaining the authentication server anymore in a couple of years. Like, what if Ubisoft goes under? They have a bad game. They have a bad string of games. Nobody buys them. They spend a whole bunch of money. They go under. They can't afford to keep running these servers. They haven't built in some backup where they flick a switch and your game all of a sudden works. Which, how is it supposed to? How's it supposed to work? When you bought this game, you put it in your PC and it starts checking 10 years down the road for Ubisoft's servers, and it can't find them. How are you going to know that you have to patch it? What if you bought the game used? What if it doesn't come with any documentation anymore, and you've lost it all? Thank goodness there's some people out there that are hard at work to make sure you can enjoy the games how you want and when you want. And you can find those all over the place. So you can, you know, buy your game in the store. So, you know, the people who make the game still get some money, and then go search for the game and add the word torrent at the end, or, you know, some of those other places, so you can have a backup of your game in case the internet goes down, rather than some corporations locking down your enjoyment more and more each year. Now, if this was the norm through all of video game history, our collection of classic video games wouldn't stretch more than 5 or 10 years back. I personally own hundreds of pre-90 video games pre-90s video games that all work today. I can pop it in. It doesn't phone home. It just works. So I fear that we're going to be soon entering in the dark ages of video games, where there'll be no legal way to enjoy video games that are more than about 5 years old, because they're all going to be phoning home. And when they find the server's not there, they're not going to work. So you're going to have no used market for these games, and people are going to start throwing them away. And the only copies left that are going to work are the non-legal copies. So soon there won't be any legal way of playing any of these games. A dark ages indeed. There's going to be a gap of games where you cannot play them legally. People are going to have to resort to non-legal ways of getting these games. Did they think about that when they're making these back-end servers? No, they weren't thinking about that. What they're thinking about is the profits of today, not the enjoyment of tomorrow. Censorship news from France. French net filtering plan moves forward. French lawmakers voted Tuesday to approve a draft law to filter internet traffic, a measure the government says is intended to catch child pornographers. Trot that out again. The bill will now go on for a second and final reading. Critics of the catch-all bill on direct and planning for the performance of domestic security says that filtering won't stop the spread of child pornography, but could allow the government to censor other materials. The bill, known as LOPSI 2 in French, was approved by 312 votes to 214 in a vote of National Assembly on Tuesday. The government has a large majority in the Assembly. Two of its deputies abstained, with all the others voting in favor of the bill. The Senate, where the government also has a majority, will soon give the bill a second reading. If the Senate makes no amendments to the text, this will also be its final reading. As the government has declared the bill urgent, a procedural move that reduces the usual cycle of four readings to two, any disagreement between the two parliamentary chambers will be reconciled by a commission appointed by the government. The bill is a mishmash of unrelated measures, boosting the amount the police spend on security, multiplying penalties for counterfeiting checks and credit cards, increased use of CCTV cameras, extending access to the police DNA database, and authorizing the seizure of vehicles driven without a license. Among the measures dealing with the internet, it seeks to criminalize online identity theft, allow police to tap internet connections as well as phone lines during investigation, and target child pornographers by ordering ISPs to filter internet connections. ISPs will require to block access to any internet address the authorities consider necessary to prevent the distribution of child pornography. Critics of the bill who oppose the distribution of child pornography says filtering is the wrong way to go about it. In a report analyzing the economics of child pornography business, journalist Fabrice Eppelboin warned that filtering URLs will have no effect, as distributors of such material are already using encrypted peer-to-peer systems to deliver their wares. During the debate, Deputy Lionel Tardy cited a report from the French Federation of Telecommunications said that filtering would cost up to 140 million euros, yet remained largely ineffective against the main distribution channels for child pornography. As if that weren't enough, others say that blocking sites suspected of hosting child pornography is likely to affect blameless such sites such as the same IP address, so-called collateral damage. Opposition deputies tried unsuccessfully to amend the bill to require blocking of only specific URLs or documents to avoid this problem. They also wanted a judge to review the list of blocked URLs each month to ensure the sites were not needlessly blocked and make sure the filters are a temporary measure until their effectiveness was proven. But those amendments were too rejected by the government majority. Once the filter is in place, said the opponents, it could be used to limit access to other internet sites. President Nicolas Sarkozy is already thinking along those lines. In a speech to the members of the French music publishing industries in January, Sarkozy said the authorities should experiment with filtering to automatically remove all forms of piracy from the internet. So just like all the other countries in the world that are proposing the internet filter or already have implemented the internet filter, it's a slippery slope to just implementing blocking websites that you don't desire or that the industry doesn't desire or lobby groups don't desire. It's a foolproof method of censorship through the government of things that you don't like. It's a slippery slope. And it's been proven time and time again that it's an easy, slippery slope to slide down when your own president is proposing to use it to block sites that are undesirable, but passed in the name of child pornography, the magic key, child pornography to getting any law passed. Privacy news from the U.S. Parents, school used webcam to spy on our kids at home. School-issued laptops are becoming more and more common these days, but thanks to the action of one high school, students and parents might have second thoughts about bringing them home. The parents of a Pennsylvania high school student, Blake J. Robbins, have filed a lawsuit against his school district after discovering the school officials had allegedly been remote accessing the laptop in order to take webcam photos of the students at home. There are a number of unanswered questions about this story, but if true, it could mean serious penalties for the Lower Merion School District. According to the complaint, the school in question has issued laptops equipped with built-in webcams to every student so they could have 24 access to school-based resources and the ability to work seamlessly between school and home when it comes to research and projects. In November 2009, however, Robbins was disciplined by the assistant principal of his school, Lindy Matsko, for engaging in improper behavior in his home. The principal of his school was disciplining the child for engaging in improper behavior at home. At that time, Matsko cited a photograph from the built-in webcam on the laptop. Robin's father, Michael, supposedly confirmed with Matsko that the school has the ability to remotely activate the webcam at any time it chooses to view and capture whatever images were in front of the webcam. Needless to say, Robin's parents were outraged at this development, and neither the school nor the district had told parents about this capability. As a result, the Robins have filed a class action lawsuit against the district, charging it with the interception of electronic communications under the ECPA, theft of intellectual property under the CFAA, violations of the Stored Communications Act, violations of the Civil Rights Act, invasions of privacy, and violations of the Pennsylvania Wiretapping and Electronic Surveillance Act. ARS tried to get clarification from the Harrington High School about its laptop policy, but we're told that no one at the school will be willing to discuss it with us. As such, we're left to speculate as to what else could have happened to let it lead up to the seemingly surreal series of events. So children, when you get your laptops home, make sure you put a piece of tape over the webcam while you're changing for school in the morning. Otherwise, your principal could be watching you while you change. Please protect your privacy, or just close the lid. Or refuse to take the laptop and use your own. Or do whatever it takes to protect your own privacy. This is absurd. This is outrageous if this is true. Unbelievable that they're accessing the laptop to look at you, what you're doing at home. And who cares what you're doing at home? This is home. They should not have the access to be able to access the laptop outside of school time. It is the school laptop, yes, but it's not on school property. Completely inappropriate. Now, in the media section, this was sent in by Bethany. Digital books and your rights, a checklist for readers off of EFF.org. Some very good information if you're starting to get into ebooks and ebook readers, so you know what's going on with your reader and what rights you have and what rights they're taking away or what they can monitor. After several years of false starts, the universe of digital books seems to last to poise to expand dramatically. Readers should view this expansion with both excitement and wariness. Excitement because digital books could revolutionize reading, making books and more findable and more accessible to more people in more ways than ever before. Wariness because the various entities that will help make this digital book revolution possible may not always respect the rights and expectations that the readers, authors, booksellers, and librarians have built up and defended over generations of experience with physical books. As new digital book tools services roll out, we need to be able to evaluate not only the cool features they offer, but also whether they extend or hamper our rights and expectations. The overarching question: are digital books as good or better than physical books at protecting your rights as a reader? Below, we offer a checklist that can help guide your inquiry, as well as the extended explanation as why the answers to these questions matter. Not surprisingly, some of these issues overlap. For example, digital rights management, or DRM, matters not only because of the limitation it places on users, but because of its impact on innovation and competition. Yet by separating out the various issues, we hope to spur a more rigorous consideration of the various digital book offerings. Our goal is not to tell authors, publishers, vendors, and libraries, or anyone else what strategies they must adopt, or tell book purchasers what options they must choose. We hope that a robust marketplace emerges with various business models and technologies. Instead, this checklist represents the key questions that readers should ask of each new digital book product or service to evaluate whether it adequately protects their interests. That source of rigorous inquiry will help us decide which digital book future we want and how to vote with our feet until we get it. So, continues on their website with a huge list of considerations you should keep in mind when taking a look at which ebook reader you're getting, whether it's even if it's a free reader that you run on your computer, and which ebooks you're downloading, because we have seen in the past where they can even just revoke your rights to a book and take it off your reader after you've purchased money, regardless of if they refund your money. They're taking a book away from you. They can't go into your house and take a physical book away from you. Why should they be able to go onto your product that you've paid money for and take a book that you've paid money for away from you, regardless of what its contents was? So our closing track and closing words are from Stephen Fry on piracy. That was posted last year on the Pirate Party UK YouTube account, and he puts it very nicely and succinctly, as Stephen Fry does on so many subjects. He's wonderful. And remember, if any of these stories have interested you at all, please check out your local pirate party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have news stories you'd like to hear in the show, questions or comments, head over to the piratepartyradio.com website and submit them through the form. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
You're not either a pirate or a good citizen. And I think if people get too, if the creative industry gets too snotty about pirates and criminalizes and tries to create too much of this, you're a thief business, people go, oh, fuck off. You know? They're just going to go, you know, I've seen you in your Rolls Royce in your house in Barbados. Don't come to me moaning like this. You know, they've got to use the imagination, which supposedly put them where they are, i.e. as creative artists, they've got to use that, their human imagination, to find a way to say, let's sort this out in such a way that there will still be an incentive, if artists have an incentive other than that of being artists, there will still be an incentive to write books and to write songs and to perform them and to own their copyrights. That will still exist as an incentive, but also there will be, you know, a way of disseminating it around that isn't so locked in with ridiculous zones and codes and things. That's my view. Open to saying that I am in a profession that is overpaid and overpraised and overpampered, and particularly overpaid. And yes, I have pirated software. I will admit it. And if that's a shock announcement for someone, you know, who's had a computer for 30 years, then how naive can you be?